Oh, thank you for coming out on a Sunday night. Any of you here not here this morning? There'd be a few. Okay, so I was going to give just a little bit of an orientation anyway to sort of bring the two together. So we'll do that. Has everybody got one of those sheets of paper? Did they all, for those who've come for the first time tonight, I'm not going to be going through it, but just want to know if you've got one, so for future reference. Were they, anyway, there are, if you want one, you can stick your hand up and someone will get you one. But when, last year when I met, Ryan and Jen in Vancouver, we just had this lovely sense of connection heart to heart, and Ryan then asked if I'd come over here, and he had accessed somewhere this, I don't know whether I'd sent it to you, Ryan, or whether you just found it, I can't remember, but anyway, you'd come across this this sheet with these notes on it, a slightly different form, but pretty much the same thing. And it comes from about 15 years ago of Sue and I opening our home to a number of friends and newer people who we just wanted to sit and tease out for ourselves just what the implications of the gospel might actually be for the manner in which we live. And with the sense that many of us had come together with some significant questions, I think, and deep underlying uncertainties and questions around the way that we had always talked about faith and gone about the way that we'd lived our lives, and had the sneaking suspicion that there was something more wonderful, something more profound to the gospel than perhaps we had actually recognised. And not in the sense of wanting to add any new experience or anything like that, but simply in wanting to appreciate what it is that that Christ had actually done for us. Now, on that image that you've got up there, you can see that, sorry, it's not exactly the best to read, is it? I'm sorry about that anyway. Hopefully, some of you who are distracted and bored and find me not worth listening to, you might just spend your night trying to read that last point on the right-hand side, which is a bit faded. But that's just so that you know that on that sheet that you've been handed out, those numbers there, they represent the numbers on that sheet. So I never wrote those points intending them to be a kind of series like this, this morning, tonight, and tomorrow night. But it was more a case of just jotting down in some sort of order my sense of what unfolds for me as I look at the scriptures as one really big story. And lurking behind those points was the growing conviction for me that there are two questions that we have to keep returning to, and I mentioned this morning, two questions we have to keep returning to, and we need to be able to answer them well. The first question is a kind of double-headed question, but it's who is Jesus and what has he done? So it's the question around Jesus. And the second question is, what does it mean to be human? And my conviction, and I mentioned this morning, is that if we can answer one well, we will answer the other one well. And if we answer one poorly, we will answer the other one poorly as well. So that, for example, if I have an impoverished understanding of what it is to be human, I will have an impoverished understanding of who Christ is and was, including even as the resurrected Jesus. If I have a rich understanding, I think, of who Christ is, I think it works in both directions, but if I have a rich understanding of who Christ is, then I, in turn, will come to know what it means to be human in a richer way. The old theologian, John Calvin, at the time of the Reformation, wrote this huge work called The Institutes of the Christian Religion. And I think that the crowning piece of his work is, in fact, his opening lines. In the very first part of the very first book, he simply says this, knowing God, knowing self, knowing God. In other words, he expands it a little and says, with the true knowledge of oneself comes the true knowledge of God. With the true knowledge of God comes a true knowledge of oneself. And he goes on to argue, and I think rightly, and others have as well, that that is in fact because we image God who is one and three. Image a God who is relational. Father, Son, and Spirit. Where each knows themselves as they know the other and as they are known by the other. And we find that it's in this quite extraordinary manner that we as the image of God reflect exactly the same phenomena. That as we come to know God truly, we come to know ourselves truly. As we come to know ourselves truly, we come to know God truly. And it's lovely how it then works sideways as well. So that as I come to know Sue well, even after 36 years of marriage, still coming to know her well, I will come to know myself well. And the same with my children. And in fact, I cannot know who I am except I enter deeply into relationship with her and with my children and with my friends and with new friends when I meet them in places like this. The more I hold back from people, the less I can possibly know them, but also I actually start to become dark even to myself. I begin to lose knowledge even of myself. So it's a marvelous thing, and an important thing that we realize that with the true knowledge of Christ comes a true knowledge, not only just individually of ourselves, but a true knowledge of what it is to be human, that which we share. But this is far from simply theological or philosophical in some sense of just a matter of ideas. This is at the heart of how we live. And so I would argue, for example, that if I have an impoverished view of what it is to be human, if I think fundamentally that to be human is a problem, if I think fundamentally of being human as being in some way evil, I think of us as some way or another a sort of a scar or a blight upon the cosmos, then I will have difficulty understanding how it is that Jesus is truly human. And likewise, I am likely to end up with a faith where I will see faith in terms of shame and of guilt and of fear. I will see it in terms constantly of my unworthiness and all of what I am meant to do to get myself to a position where God might actually smile upon me. Whereas I think that when we have a rich sense of who Christ is and what he's actually done on our behalf, and with that comes a renewed understanding of what it means to be his image and his glory, which is what we are. We are his image and we are his glory. Then what follows from that is, so make sure you get the logic here right. What follows from that is not the idea, therefore, that I come before God with my own merit because, hey, I'm better than I thought I was. That's not where the logic goes at all. But rather that I find myself able to come before Christ by the power of his Spirit, recognizing that everything that ever needed to be done has been done in and through Jesus Christ. Everything. And that in fact, when I then, if that's the case, if I know that, if I then live a life that is in fact about trying in some way or another to compensate for what I think is my inherent defectiveness and worm-likeness, then in fact what I'm actually doing is, without realizing it, I'm pulling apart the work of Christ on my behalf. Now, I want to be careful as I go here. Tonight I'm going to say some things that may seem difficult, and I'm quite aware of that, and I want to be sensitive to that, and I want to be respectful about that. I'm asking you in some respects, or maybe expecting in some ways, hoping that you might actually warm to some things that have actually taken me a long time to get my own head and heart around. And I don't for a moment think that I'm right about everything, for heaven's sake. I'm just trying to work this out as I go, and work it out as faithfully as I can. But you know, it's interesting. This morning, when I spoke about Jesus, and the emphasis, for those who weren't there, the emphasis I put was on how the scriptures are one whole big, wonderful, true story. And I worked it from Jesus walking on the road to, the two disciples walking to Emmaus from Jerusalem after Jesus has been raised from the dead, and they still think he's dead. And Jesus comes alongside of them, and what I attempted to do this morning was to try and do something in some spirit like what I suspect Jesus did with them. I'm sure that what I did was in very pale comparison to what Jesus actually did. But I think what he probably did, walking those 7 miles with those two people, was effectively tell them their own story. Tell them the story that stretched from Adam through Abram, through the patriarchs, through the Exodus, down through the period of the kingship and the exile and the prophets, and the return and the wave after wave of oppression by foreign rulers. Telling a story that leaves you hanging at the end of it with the sense of how on earth are God's promises ever going to be realized, how they're ever going to be fulfilled, and with the sense that somehow this whole story has been narrowing in to one single person, the servant, and how I suggested that when Jesus broke that bread, that I suspect that when they realized he's the man, I suspect they realised not only is he, that's actually Jesus, the man we've been with for whatever amount of time and who was dead just a little while ago, but I suspect they also realised he is the one where the story has actually reached its culmination. It's all come together in him. And I suggested from Acts chapter 2 that in the way that Peter gets up and explains the presence of the Spirit, the way that he reaches back so bravely to such a bold and dramatic Old Testament prophecy as Joel chapter 2, quotes the whole thing beginning with "In the day of the Lord," that he does this because it is his conviction that everything that the prophets have longed for, that everything that is tied up in the enormous promise given to Abraham that through you will all the nations of the earth be blessed, I think Peter, by the Spirit of God, is convinced that that great day has actually occurred. It occurred when that man went to the cross and when he rose from the dead. And I finished by saying that while the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ are of equal importance, and we want to always make sure that we don't play one off against the other, I suggested that if we see the cross as the real point of the entire story, then we will always find ourselves in a position of looking back at the cross, and this is how I was raised to think, as though the resurrection is God's tick over what happened on the cross. It's simply God's affirmation of well done. And in one sense, of course, I think that's probably true. Or we might think of it as a proof that Jesus is God. Well, it's no proof that Jesus is God, because according to 1 Corinthians 15, what Jesus now experiences is what we will experience. We too will be raised from the dead as he was, and Paul says, in the twinkling of an eye, we'll find ourselves just like him. Instead, If we see that in fact, if we're given this very, very big story that stretches from a creation past to a creation to come, begins and ends in a garden, and has in itself a kind of tension around heaven and earth, both created entities, and the sense of how can they ever be reconciled with one another? They seem almost as if their faces have been turned away from one another. The marvellous ending of the story in Revelation chapters 21 and 22 is not us going to heaven, but heaven coming here. I saw heaven descend, John says. And what it results in is, in effect, Eden 2.0. Okay, Earth 2.0, Cosmos 2.0, fashioned for Adam 2.0, Jesus, the man who's been raised from the dead. And I'm suggesting that if we see that, not in any way minimizing the truth of Jesus going to the cross, carrying our sin and our judgment, but if we realize that the whole story has always been going towards God's great desire that through his Son, he would take the whole idea of humanity and creation to another level of existence. That's what he was always going to do. That his desire in the end for what humanity would be is humanity shaped after the second Adam, Jesus, and the man who begins by being incarnated in the shape of the first Adam. And at his resurrection becomes the second Adam. That's the language that Paul uses. And I think that for any of us, when we hear a message like that, I think pretty much hopefully for all of us, just hearing the sense of this big story And hearing of the centrality of Jesus to this story and realizing, for example, the story's not about us. The gospel has nothing to do with whether you and I are going to become Christians or not. That might sound like a dramatic statement, but seriously, the shortest definition you can ever give of the gospel is Jesus, full stop. Jesus, full stop. The good news declared in the heavens and upon the earth is Jesus. That God has put on kneecaps and eyebrows, saliva glands and a spleen. He's come amongst us. He's done what he has. He's gone to the cross and he's been raised from the dead. That's the news that is pronounced throughout the cosmos. Not that Mark Strom could be a Christian. You follow? The good news, the gospel, is not you and me. It's not about how we become Christians. The good news is about this God acting on our behalf, being incarnated, going to the cross, rising from the dead, and being declared forevermore to be the Lord over all things. That's proclaimed, and the Spirit of God moves our hearts such that we respond and say, it's true. It's true. And that's what faith is. Faith is the affirmation of saying, he really did rise from the dead. He really is Lord. And everyone else that I've ever regarded as Lord is an imposter. And now my life has to be reoriented to the reality of this true Lord raised from the dead. Well, for most of us, I think when we hear that, there's surely something in us that sort of, you know, rejoices. You know, I didn't expect you all to kind of, you know, react like some sort of wild charismatic audience or something like that. But I know in your hearts you were kind of, I hope, strangely warmed, you know, and are thinking, yeah, isn't he amazing? Not me. Isn't Jesus amazing? Okay? What a Savior. What a Lord. What an extraordinary story. But when we come now tonight to the second question, what does it mean to be human? This is a tougher one for us. Because I think in many ways we find it's harder to have our perceptions about who we are challenged than it is for us to hear again about Jesus. You know, it's a funny thing. I have been fascinated for years and years and years with how ideas shape people and how people shape ideas. And some of you were at the leadership stuff I did yesterday and on Friday night. And I talked a little bit there. I delved a little bit into intellectual history and back into the ancient Greeks and some places like that, trying to make sense of why do we think the way that we do. But it's fascinating how ideas come to shape our lives. And you know, they rarely shape our lives, I think, in terms of people telling us what we're supposed to do. So let me give you an example of this. I would be really surprised if anybody here has ever been taught by any Christian teacher anywhere, read anything, heard anything, watched anything, where any Christian teacher has actually implied to you that the work of Jesus is really important for dealing with your sin, but fundamentally the really key thing is that when you become aware of your sin, you have to work yourself into a place of remorse and sorrow over that sin. And that ultimately that's what really matters. And no one, I think, ever said to us that if it's a big sin, you should allow more days to feel really, really remorseful and sorrowful. And if it's a little sin, that you really don't have to worry about it for too long. Okay? You know what I'm talking about? Yes. But somehow I think we'd have picked this up. We have picked this up. You think about those of us who at any point have been asked to do something like preach a sermon or lead a Bible study or whatever else, anything like this. And something comes loose in your life somewhere, you know? And you know, if it's the week before, you don't feel too bad because there's enough time. And somehow you'll kind of work with it to, by the time Sunday comes or Wednesday night, you're sort of feeling all right about it. But if it happens like the day before or the night before, or heaven forbid, the morning before, there's just something in us that's sort of like, I can't do this. I can't do this. And sort of it's a little bit like checking your tie and your fly, that as you go to the door, it's just that Jesus, please, just forgive me, will you? Right. Let's get on with what I have to do. You know, I mean, I hope this isn't too insensitive, but in all seriousness, think of the young man who is going to preach on Sunday and he masturbates on Tuesday. There's enough time for him to somehow kind of feel like, I think I'm all right now. But goodness me, if it's Saturday night before he preaches on Sunday, he turns himself inside out all over the place, trying somehow that to cram enough kind of awareness of God and of himself and of his sin and the sort of remorse he thinks he should have, so that come Sunday morning, somehow, miraculously, he'll be able to stand up there as the man of God and say something. Nobody ever taught us this. But isn't it right that many of us have ended up living like this? Ended up feeling like this? And when we do, we deny the work of Christ. Because am I declared free from guilt? Am I declared that there's no condemnation on me on the basis of the work of Jesus, or on how well and how long I drag myself through remorse? Are you following? And this is why it has always seemed in every age for 2,000 years that when people begin to proclaim grace, somebody says it's just too easy. It's too cheap. It's too easy. And I want to suggest to you that the reason we do this is not the prompting of the Spirit of God, but the innate ideas that we have about who we are as human beings, who we are as the image of God, which do not allow us to be able to live boldly, being able to say, yes, Lord, I have sinned. Thank you again that you do not condemn me. Thank you again. Thank you by your Spirit, I do not have to play this absurd and life-sucking game of dragging myself through all kinds of things to try and make myself feel better and make myself feel worthy of your acceptance. You realize when we do this, we've completely lost the plot on what Jesus has done for us. We of all people are the ones who should know what it is to be bold about this. So, let me enter this question then of what it means for us to be human. The scriptures open for us in the first chapters of Genesis with the declaration at the end of chapter 1 that we, men and women, we are the image of God. And you may have heard through various speakers at various times the idea, and I think it's a sound idea, that the Genesis texts are in many respects reflect the world around them, the world of ancient Egypt and the Mesopotamian world, which is only understandable given that those who put this together, Moses and whoever helped Moses, they've had 400 years of slavery in Egypt, and they're more familiar with the Egyptian religion and gods than they are with Yahweh. They're more familiar probably with the Mesopotamian gods that have come along with Abram than they are with the true God Yahweh. Moses makes that pretty clear when God meets him in the burning bush and he doesn't really understand who God is. Doesn't understand who Yahweh is, and Yahweh has to explain it to him. And I think it's right when people draw connection and see that in many respects that the text of the story of creation is written with an eye to saying to those people who've come from Egypt, the stories you were told there are false. The perceptions that you picked up there about what the world is and who God is and how God works are false. I'm going to give you the true story. You do not have to fear the sun and the moon. They are not gods. They are created by God. And as part of that, in all the great stories of creation, the gods fashion the creation, as it were, almost like a temple. And the idol of the god is placed inside there. And when, of course, they dedicated the temples of ancient gods, they would do it in a way that sort of reflected almost the creation story. But our creation story ends in the most amazing way, where the cosmos, which the Psalms will tell us, I think, is actually the temple of God. The cosmos, when God makes his own temple, he places inside it his own image. And it's not made out of bronze and wood and copper. It's made out of flesh and blood. It laughs, it cries, it walks, it sings, it brings forth babies, it designs, it creates music and architecture and all these extraordinary things. This is the image that God places inside his own temple at the very end. And in Genesis 1, finishes, of course, with God declaring of everything he's made, including you and me, it is very good. It is very good. And good there doesn't mean moral. Okay? It means that it is as it should be. It means that it is full of wonder. It is full of delight. It is gorgeous. It is beautiful. It is true. It's not about morality in any shape at all. We intrinsically are the image and the glory of God. And that's a connection that comes further as you go through the scriptures, that we as the image of God actually are the glory of God. It's a long way from we are worms, isn't it? So let me go then to chapter 2 and chapter 3. And I want to talk to you about the tale of two trees. You know that in Genesis 2 and Genesis 3, that the drama that unfolds around the rebellion, I think of it more as a rebellion than a fall. It's a deliberate choice there to say, we will not have God. We will, not in the way that God seeks to be God, we will have God on our own terms. I don't think that's a fall so much as a takeover. And in that story, it turns around two trees, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life. Now, you know the prohibition is do not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, I want you to do a little thought experiment with me, okay? You've already heard that this morning I tried to do a little imaginative thing with you. I want you to do another one with me, okay? Genesis chapter 2. Well, let's imagine. Let's imagine that Genesis chapter 2 goes on for a very, very long time. Okay? Let's imagine a long, long, long time before ever there's a Genesis 3. So you're following me here? The man and the woman. No sin. No complication. Okay, your turn to talk back to me. What are they doing? What's the man and the woman doing? Genesis 2, it's going on and on and on. They're keeping the garden. They're talking to God in the evening, having those beautiful walks at night. They're naming animals. I missed that one. The honey-do list. That's a Canadianism. I don't know that one. Come on. Come on, guys, I'm an Aussie. Is that some sort of polite way of saying they had sex? Or oh, you make a list of... Oh, okay. I'm with you. Well, of course, if the woman made the list, it might not be on there, but if the man made the list... It's every third item, you know, that's right. Yeah. So imagine this goes on. There's got to be some of that going on. Absolutely. They've been told to do this, okay? Keep going. What else? What else is happening? Yeah, the fellowship with the Lord, sure. They're not ashamed. They have no concept of what that means. Gee, you're a tame lot, you know. You're all staying with the kind of, you know, yeah, sort of, they're really being... nicely religious, I suppose, is sort of what they're doing in the garden. Come on. Sorry? Thank you. Let's go from this one. They're exploring. They're enjoying it. They're seeing animals in the cloud and go, what the heck? And go, whoa! You know? Eve, you'll never guess what I saw. You'll never guess. Come and have a look. What else? I'm going to come up here, Michelle. You tell me. I didn't.
They're exploring the world around them.
They absolutely are. They are exploring the world around them. Can you imagine? I wonder what's behind this tree. I wonder what's around that corner. I wonder what's down through the creek. That's what they're doing. I wonder what's up and over this hill or that mountain. That's exactly what they're doing. But keep going. What else are they doing?
Probably inventing things.
Thank you. They're dreaming? Yeah. What could be? What could be? See, whose image do they bear? Who is? A creator. Can't you imagine what it would have been like the first time one of them whistled? Just a little sound that came out. Ooh. Whoa. And before you know it, you've got a tune. Before you know it, you've got music. Or can you imagine the first time somebody, one of them started to sort of rub their hand in the sand or the dirt or something, and they started, they're looking at a tree and they started doing something in the dirt and went, huh, look at that. Look at that. And there's art. And maybe they think about a shelter and there's architecture. And on and on and on it goes. You know, it's fascinating. As Christians, we have real trouble letting our minds go straight there. We think that if Adam and Eve are doing what they should be doing, they're either basically going down tending the vegetable garden or they're having prayer meetings. And that's fundamentally all there is to life. But it isn't. We're a timid bunch, you know. I sort of have this is going to sound really cheeky, I know, but I have this kind of playful picture in my head about Adam and Eve as evangelical Christians. And because you know, yeah, because you know, we're amongst company here, right? Evangelical Christians are really uptight, you know. They are worried about getting it wrong. This is why we always keep asking what God's will is. We're not actually all that interested in what it is, but we keep asking Him what it is, right? We want to know. We sort of say, yeah, red car, blue car. I don't want to make decisions. God, you tell me, you know. Africa, India. Well, you know, I don't want to. It's just a lot of responsibility. I don't want to make the decision. God, please tell me which place I should go to. You know, should I marry that woman, or that woman? You should be so lucky, okay? You know, I don't want the responsibility. You know, so I, Sue, that was, I didn't really mean that, okay? You're the only one. But I, in my playful imagination, think of in the cool of the evening, God turns up. And the man and the woman say to God, look, we're keen to get on with this thing that you've given us to do, to be fruitful, multiply, subdue. And Adam says, especially the multiply bit, really into that. And they say, but we just don't want to get this, I don't know, we don't have a word for wrong yet, but I just don't want to, we don't want me to. So could you give me a hint? You know, should we go north first? Should we go down north in the garden? And I imagine in my playfulness of God saying, yeah, there it is. It's a beautiful garden, isn't it? It's all yours. It's all yours. Yeah, okay. But, like, all right, fine. So northeast, southwest is okay. It's a beautiful garden and it's all yours. Okay, all right. Well, we were wondering. We were thinking, we've noticed fruit and we've noticed vegetables. And we were kind of wondering, like, should we start on the vegetables first? There it is. It's a beautiful garden. It's all yours. Enjoy. Be fruitful, multiply, subdue, fill, name, etc. Get on with it. You can hear what I'm saying, can't you? The sort of the timidity and the sense of fearfully hoping I won't get it wrong. Except, of course, in the true story of Genesis 2, there is none of that because there is no knowledge of good or evil. Can you imagine what it would be like for that scenario to go on and go on and go on and come back to what our friend at the back said here? And there is no shame because, in fact, there is no concept of shame. There is no concept of good. There is no concept of evil. That's very difficult for us to grasp, isn't it? We think of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil as the tree of the knowledge of evil. But it's not the tree of the knowledge of evil. It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The good is as problematic as the evil. At this point in their existence, living under God, they have not only no knowledge or experience of evil or any need to have knowledge of evil, they have no knowledge of good. And they don't need a knowledge of good. You follow? Can you hear what I'm saying here? It is what it is. The world is what it is. God is who He is. God can be trusted. We are who we are. We are the image of God. I don't need any idea of morality or good or bad. Simply, we are here. This is His magnificent world. And we're to get on and fill this earth and do all those extraordinary things that human beings have been made to do. But when we then read in Genesis 3, And that whole tragic story of the serpent and the fruit, and they eat of it, and the irony of ironies, the fruit seemed to be good for wisdom, for gaining wisdom. What a terrible irony. They already are wise. Think about it. They read the world rightly, truly. They read the world truly. They know who the Creator is. They don't distort the Creator-creature thing. They know there's a Creator, I'm the creature. Nothing's mucking that up in any way at all. They know that, and therefore they know this world is God's world, not our world, but it's been given to us as a gift. All that's really clear. We know who we are. We're equals with one another. We know what it is to care for one another, to nurture one another, to be fascinated by one another, to be curious about one another, to know one another. And all of a sudden, along comes this lie. Yeah, but you will gain an insight into something you don't have right now. And God's holding it right back because, frankly, He can't be trusted. And if you have this knowledge, you will be able, in some sense, to displace God. And so as soon as they eat, as soon as they acquire this knowledge of good and evil, what follows then is the distorting of absolutely every relationship. Everything is twisted and turned inside out. The first, of course, thing to happen is blame. She gave it to me. The snake, the serpent, whatever it is, that. And of course, the beginning of it all, where are you? Where are you? Where are you? We're hiding. Why are you hiding? Because we're naked. Who told you you're naked? In other words, the idea of nakedness doesn't even enter into the mind in Genesis chapter 2. You follow? There's no notion of being clothed. There is just being what you are, the image of God. Now they're there hiding their genitals behind a tree somewhere and whatever. Why? And it would seem the only thing is that in some way or another, at the most intimate expression of humanity, of man and woman, of being one flesh, at the most vulnerable and intimate place, they first feel the shame of what they have done. And so at the place where they are meant to bond in the most intimate way, they find themselves repulsed from one another. And the fascinating thing is that from there on, everything is set up in these binary terms. Good and evil, right and wrong, in and out, included and excluded, black, white, you name it. Every human being ever since has lived their lives, we live our lives, with a default, a kind of a binary default. You know that word binary from computers? Ones and zeros, all these strange things we rely upon that have got computers going, they all rely on somebody writing out code that has combinations of ones and zeros. Seems bizarre, doesn't it? It keeps airplanes in the air. Staggering, isn't it? The whole world is built upon all this stuff nowadays, these electronic things, ones and zeros. But the word binary, I think, is a good word for describing what we've inherited. A sense of as though all things in life are either this or either that. And they're irreconcilable in some ways. And we see each other this way. And I think that what we've inherited with this, what this has come to do in us, is we have found that there is some incredibly deep predilection towards performance. I'm all the time trying to find some measure somewhere so that I can know whether I'm okay or not. So I can know whether you're okay or not. And whether I've measured up to this. Our whole life, since we were this big at schools, we've done this to each other since we were this big. The moment we first put anything on a piece of paper, somebody graded it. We learned to second guess the teachers. What do they really want? That's what I've got to do. Not find my way as a genuine, true individual human being. No, but figure out what do they want so I can give it back to them. And if I give it back to them in the right way, I will score okay and they will regard me as an all right person and a student. And if I don't score okay, I'm going to be regarded as one of these students down here. And then what will my peers think of me? And if I do score really well and I'm up here, then I have the opportunity to now look down on other people. And our whole lives, in many respects, have become shaped by expectation and standards and measures and performance of how we think we're supposed to live. Let me give you a really, really practical example of this. Think of some friends decide to get together one Friday night, to have a meal together, have a good time together. And imagine, I'm sure this has never happened to you, but just imagine for the sake of the argument, that Friday night's coming up, and I start to feel anxious about what I'm going to wear. I'm anxious about whether my clothes are going to be right, whether my friends will actually find them acceptable or not. I'm worried about whether the food and the drink that I bring is actually going to be appropriate, or whether I'm just going to look really sort of dumb and awkward because I brought the wrong stuff. I'm a bit worried about, like, if you turn up early, does that make you look a bit too eager? And if you turn up late, does that just look a little too slobby? Like, how should I do this? And, oh, Harry's going to be there. Harry's awkward. I'm not sure quite how will I work the evening so I'm not stuck with Harry in a corner somewhere, right? And you probably know someone who's felt anxiety like this, you know? I doubt anyone in the room has ever felt like this, you know? But the entire night, in one way or another, in our minds, gets structured around whether it's good or it's evil. We wouldn't use those words, but whether it's right or it's wrong, whether it's awkward or it's cool, you know, whether it's clumsy or it's refined, whether it is going to meet with appreciation and acceptance, or whether it'll actually add to the growing rejection of me by these other people. You following? But imagine a different scenario. Imagine a group of friends that have come to be so comfortable with one another that they don't do this. And I hope you've had an experience like this at some stage, where we find that it is just such good company to be with one another that you just really look forward to it. And you know, I'm going to turn up straight from work and I'm going to be filthy, you know, because I'm not going to have time to get home. And no one cares. It's like, just take your boots off. Like, that's fine, you know, we don't mind. And someone else turns up from work and they've still got their suit on and whatever else, or some come dressed really casual. And, you know, we've got that friend who's sort of very arty and she just looks fantastic all the time. And I just look like a slob, but hey, well, that's all right. You know, that's who I am, you know. And it doesn't seem to matter. And then you get there and you find this, it becomes this really funny point that all six of you bought lasagna and white wine, you know. And it's the same white wine, you know? And you kind of shrug it off and you laugh and you just think this is going to make one of those great stories one day. We'll sit around and tell each other about, do you remember that night we all turned up with the same stuff? It's a night without the anxiety of am I okay or am I not okay? Well, I don't want to make this just folky. I want to suggest that how deeply problematic this whole binary thing is. And I want to come back to Jesus. And I want to suggest that something else is going on with him. You see, I think if we don't have a rich sense of who Christ is and what it is to be the image of God, then we will tend to think that the whole point of our experience of faith is about sin spotting. That somehow or another what I'm meant to do is get better and better and better at discerning good and evil in me and in others. That what God wants me to be the sin police for myself and for others here and maybe even in the wider society. That's fundamentally what it means to be a person of faith and to follow the man who was crucified on the cross for all of our sins. I got to get better and better and better at figuring out what's sin and what isn't sin, and I got to spend my time trying to make sure I do not stuff it up. I do not sin. Now, don't hear me as saying that we do not sin. Not for a moment. But let me give you an analogy. Ask yourself how well you can live. Maybe this is coming close to the bone for some of you. I don't know. But the scriptures love to give the analogy of marriage. Of the relationship between God and us as being like a relationship of marriage. Now, I want you to imagine this. Imagine that you wake up, guys, you wake up in the morning, you look across, and there's that that wonderful woman, and you say to yourself, oh, heck, I could really stuff it up today. I could really disappoint her. I could hurt her. I could even be unfaithful to her. How the heck am I going to stop myself doing this today? And I become preoccupied with all the things that I've got to do to make sure that I'm better than that. And I go to the seminars, and I read the books, and I read all the things about how to be the proper Christian husband. And I become absorbed with all these rules and good advice about how to do this thing. And every morning I wake up and look across, and there's that woman again, and think to myself, oh boy, I really don't want to stuff it up today, and I'm so glad I got a few extra tips and rules the other day from that seminar I went to, and I'll try to make sure I do those today and I don't stuff it up with my wife. I know I'm being a little bit hamming it up, but imagine the alternative. Imagine, guys, that we wake up, we look across, and we say, there she is again. I have given her so many good reasons to go. I have given her ample justification to leave. And she's still there. She's still there. She still loves me. She still welcomes me into her life. She still wants me to be with the children that she bore into this world. And there's still more about her I don't know. I wonder what it would be like today if I came to know her just that little bit more. I wonder what that would be like. I wonder what I might be able to do today to some way or another enter it fully into her world with her, to engage with her in some way perhaps I've never done before. I don't quite know how to plan it or whatever. I just hope I'm kind of aware at the time when it happens. But there she is. Oh, my head. I can think of so many reasons why I don't deserve this. But there she is. What a gift. I want to grow in knowing this woman. Can you sense the difference between these two? Can you sense the parallel to faith? We think that the only way for our lives to look better, and you can hear all that stuff as soon as we use language like better, of performance and standard and expectation and whatever else, we think the only way for our lives to ever be transformed is to become more and more obsessed with the question of sin and how I can eradicate sin from my life. Please hear me again. I know that I sin. Okay? I'm not playing with that idea in the least. But I'm asking you to think about what actually makes for growth. I'll tell you what makes for growth. It's not spotting sin. It's recognizing grace. It's feeling again the wonder of a God who says he's never actually going to condemn. Now, I think when you come to the person of Jesus, I think we see in him so many things. But here's one thing I think we see. I think for the first time since Genesis 2, we see what it looks like for a human being to live without the knowledge of good and evil in the way that it became problematic for the man and the woman. A man whose life is not shaped according to what is good and what is evil, or what is right and what is wrong, but a man who's following some other tune. A man whose life is about life. You see, look at the life of Jesus in the Gospels. And in so many places, he actually doesn't look right, does he, to us? He certainly didn't look right to the people around him. He must be a drunkard and a glutton. Why? Well, because he hangs around with people that are. And we've given good Christian advice since the year dot of saying, for heaven's sake, don't go to the pub, people will think the wrong thing of you. Well, Jesus did. And a lot worse than that, okay? But Jesus' life doesn't actually seem to match this in any way. I don't know whether you realize this. I hope I'm not upsetting too much. I believe with Hebrews that Jesus is sinless, okay? I'm right there, fully orthodox about that. But do you realize Jesus actually did break the law? And actually did set the law aside? I agree with Paul that he fulfilled the law on our behalf. I agree that he's blameless under the law. But in terms of what his actual actions were, he actually does not do exactly what he's supposed to do. Here's my favourite passage about this. And the one that I think illustrates what I'm trying to expound here, I know it's not in all the ancient manuscripts, but here we'll go. It's Jesus and the woman caught in adultery. The opening 12 verses of John chapter 8. You know the story? So the Pharisees have somehow, who knows how this has happened, caught this woman supposedly red-handed in the act of adultery, and they've brought her towards Jesus. No mention of the man, you'll notice, but they bring the woman because, frankly, the woman doesn't matter. She doesn't count. It's not about her, as John says. It's about Jesus. They're trying to trap Jesus. So they bring this woman before Jesus and basically saying, this is what the law says. Okay, what should happen here? You tell us, Rabbi. Like, you're on the spot here. You know the law. The woman's caught in adultery. She's not denying it. You know what the law says. Okay, so let's see where you come down, Jesus. You claim that God is with you. And Jesus asks this wonderfully grounded question, or makes this wonderfully grounded comment. Let him who is without sin cast the first stone. And the old guys go, oh, hang on. I'm putting my head in a noose here. Who knows? Maybe some of them were her clients. Who knows? But they sneak away quietly, like, we are complicit in this. If we follow down this track with Jesus, we are done for here. Because, you know, we're up to our necks in the same stuff. The young guys, of course, are just full of moral indignation, and they're like, get in here, yeah, yeah, come on, get her, until finally they watch and everybody's disappearing, and it's like, uh-oh, and they finally go. And all through this, Jesus does this curious thing. In between making statements and asking questions, he doodles in the sand with his finger. And there have been no end of people who've tried to imagine what Jesus was writing, you know, what message he was doing. I tend to think he was just doodling in the sand. Quite seriously, have you ever experienced someone who comes to you in moral outrage, convinced that you have done something terribly wrong, and comes to you to tell you how wrong you are? And it doesn't matter that the story is different than what they thought it was. They come to you in the full fury of their moral outrage. If you've ever experienced this, and I have, it is impossible to talk to people when they are like that. They are so trapped within their own self-righteousness that they are terrified. Like a bully is terrified of meeting you as a common human being without the luxury of their fists. So a person in moral outrage is terrified of meeting you on common ground as a human being where both of us know what it is to be broken, where both of us know what it is to sin. And you just can't talk. And I think that's what Jesus is doing when he plays in the sand. But you know what's curious? He says, let him who is without sin, cast the first stone. Was there anybody there without sin? Him. In a sense, he's invited himself. You get a word from God in the strangest ways nowadays, don't you? He, in effect, you might see it as he invites himself to throw the first rock. Let him who is without sin cast the first stone. But the law says nothing about that. The law doesn't require sinlessness before you execute judgment. The law acknowledges that everybody involved in this whole exercise is a sinner. You follow? Jesus is making a requirement the law never talks about. He, in effect, sets the law to one side. And then he says to this woman, these beautiful words, where are your accusers? They're gone, Lord. Well, neither do I accuse you. Just go and sin no more. And I think when he says go and sin no more, that's not, the point isn't, you know, well, we've finally got down to it now. He acknowledges she's a rotten, lousy, dirty woman, and the whole deal is about how we're going to get moral reform in her life. I suspect that what Jesus is actually handing to her for the first time in her life is the possibility that her life could break the cycle of what has enslaved and entrapped her. I mean, come on, this is not a woman who's living a comfortable life where she has choice over her own life. She is dragged by men and nobody protects her, and she's brought by this raging religious crowd of nutcases to Jesus. This is a woman who is extremely vulnerable. And I wonder if in Jesus' words, certainly are the sense of don't go down there anymore, but I wonder if it's the sense of you don't need to now. You don't need to. But here's what's fascinating then. If this is true, I think what we see in Jesus is a man who is not living according to the knowledge of the tree of according to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He's living in some other place. He's living where it's all about the relationship between him and his Father. It is about life, not about the knowledge of good and evil. And I suspect then that when we, in Paul's letters, I'm going to try and I'll try and shut up in a little bit. I know I'm going on a bit here, and see if we can get some interaction over this. I'll be really happy to do that with you. I thought I'd do it earlier, but you know I just get excited and I keep talking. But I find it fascinating then that when Paul, for example, comes to describe the nature of our lives, when he talks about the fruit. That what he describes when he describes the fruit of the Spirit is not a moral check sheet. It isn't, and I say I'm not trying to be smart about this. I say this particularly out of my own research into the nature of how morality worked in both the Jewish context and the Greek and Roman context. What he gives to his friends at Galatia is nothing like a list of moral virtues or moral actions. It's something entirely different. It is entirely relational. He says the fruit of the Spirit is this: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control. And at the end he says, against these things there's no law. I can't imagine that what Paul is saying is the more loving, joyful, and peaceful you are, the more you will fulfill the law. I think rather what he's saying is, as it is the case that my life is shaped by love and by joy and by peace and by gentleness and by kindness and by faithfulness, etc., that in fact there needs be no reference to the law. That what is actually happening in my life has no reference to law. Not as in I've become reckless and do whatever I want to, not in the least, but in the sense that what is happening is my life is being guided by the life that the Spirit is animating within me now as the image of God is being renewed, not after the first Adam, but after the second Adam. And Paul's shorthand for this is to talk about flesh and spirit. And here's where it gets awkward and tricky for us. If you have an NIV Bible there, you might want to flick to this at some point. If you look up Romans chapter, in fact, maybe someone could do this for us. Someone got an NIV Bible. Could you just flick to Romans chapter 8, verse 9 for us? Has anybody here got one? Okay. Anyone who can shout it out. Romans 8, verse 9, NIV Bible. Could you just read the first half of the verse for us? That'll do. Can you, Brianna, can you just do it a little bit louder for us? And okay. You, however, are not controlled by the sinful nature if the Spirit of God lives within you. Okay. The moment you hear those words, sinful nature, what do you assume? Sorry? That will never sin. Probably the other way with the thought of a sinful nature, that we will sin. Yeah, so there's one picture of it is that perhaps my life is shaped. If I think sinful nature, I think in terms of my life is shaped by laws that God actually didn't intend. Anyone else? There's a really obvious place you can go.
The lust of the pride of life and the lust of the flesh.
All that stuff, yeah, but what else? Sorry? Human nature, what else? You're a rare man to say that Romans 7 is plain, but
not able to do. The things I wish not to do, I find myself, I'm doing.
Yeah.
Then he cries out, he said, O wretched man, who shall deliver me from this body of death? But then he kept to faith, and he finalized his the Holy Spirit wonderful words saying, thanks be to Jesus Christ. And so, in the garden before, when we were without shame, we did not know between right or good, but then we fell. But then the Lord Jesus came and took that curse away on him. So now, as a children of God, we could come like the Apostle Paul and say, Lord, I know I couldn't do it, but thanks to you for living in me, just like you read in Romans chapter 8, that the Spirit in you is helping me daily to overcome that.
That's a wonderful summary, but I want to suggest that that what Paul actually says is even stronger and better than that. When you hear the phrase sinful nature, most of us have learned to couple that with some other phrase, spiritual nature, as if there are two parts to us, as though the idea of flesh and spirit is like my flesh and my spirit. Or are you a really rare group of people that you've never picked up that lousy idea? But for many, many Christians, this is the common idea. You can hear of things like feeding the black dog, or feeding the white dog and starving the black dog. You remember things like that? All that sort of stuff, this idea that somehow I'm going to have to suppress the sinful nature in me to allow the spiritual nature to come forward. The NIV translators really should be shot for what they did with that. And they know better than that. There is no controlled by in the Greek text there. There is no phrase sinful nature in the text there. The words are very, very simple. Here's what Paul says. You, however, are not in the flesh, but in the spirit. You, however, are not in the flesh, but in the spirit. As simple and as blunt and as bold as that, Paul says that our identity is not in the flesh. Our identity is not flesh, is not, nor is our true name sinner. Our identity is in Christ. Our identity is in the Spirit. Because for Paul, the whole idea of flesh and spirit is not about two parts to me. That's Plato. That's Plato's picture from a long, long way back that has persisted in his separating of the world into what matters and what doesn't matter. But for Paul, it's a much simpler picture than that. There are two men whose lives characterize the entirety of humanity, the first Adam and the second Adam. This is Romans 5 and 1 Corinthians 15. And those two orders of being human are known as flesh and spirit. One is characterized by death, one by life. One is characterized by sin, one is characterized by righteousness. Fascinatingly enough, the flesh, Adam, is characterized by law. And the spirit is characterized by spirit. Those are the contrasts that Paul makes all the way through it. When it comes to our identity, he's saying this, be really, really clear from here on. Brothers and sisters, friends, seriously, realize this. Your identity is in Christ, in him. Not in the flesh, whatever you think that means. You don't have two natures. You don't have a split identity. You have one identity in Christ. When we sin, we do not act according to our true nature. We act contrary to our true nature. When we sin, we do not act according to who we are. We act according to who we were. Go back to the analogy of the marriage. Sue and I have been married for 36 years, as I said. I could still choose to act on any given day, or for who knows how long for here, to act like a single man. You follow? I could choose to just go that place in my head and act like I have no covenant with Sue, nor my children, and act like a single man. But it actually does not change the reality. I am in Sue, in covenant. And she is in me. That's the truth. And for me, therefore, to live with her well is not to play around with who am I really? Am I really a single man, or am I really in Sue, in relationship with her? The only way to live well is to recognize, no, my true identity is in her. That's who I am. And that means for us to come back and recognize grace and realize that the only way transformation, the only way change happens for us is not by dwelling upon our sin. Again, hear me clearly here. I am not seeking to say we don't sin, nor am I seeking to say it doesn't matter, nor am I seeking to say it has no significance. I'm not saying anything like that at all. But I'm saying it is a lie when we let that predominate our understanding of what faith is about. Faith is about grace. Freedom comes from recognizing what it is that God has done on our behalf. I'll finish this bit just with this. Years ago, I decided to never ask for forgiveness again. Just bear with me. That sounds terrible, doesn't it? Just bear with me. Bear with me. I decided years ago, on the basis of reading 1 John, to never ever ask God for forgiveness ever again. But I confess. I say to him, Lord, you know I've sinned. You know the truth. You know why I don't ask for forgiveness? Any of you got any idea why I don't ask for forgiveness? Because it's done. Because it's not an open question. If I wrong you and I come to you, I do need to ask for forgiveness because it's not a done deal that you have forgiven me. That's something we've got to work out, whether that's going to happen. But when I come to Jesus, it is not an open question. There is no condemnation. And I think in Romans 7, what Paul is saying is simply this. No matter who I am, Pharisee before I meet Jesus on the road to Damascus, or apostle many, many years after writing this letter, it doesn't matter who I am. If I make the law the reference point for my life, if I make performance and measurement and all that comes with it the reference point for my life, I can only ever know two things in my life. I will either condemn myself or I'll justify myself. I'll either condemn you or I'll justify you. That's all I can ever do. I will view you and me in terms of performance. And that's why he cries out and says that it's wretched. What a wretched way to live, when my life is structured by law and all the expectations that come with it. And instead, he says, thanks be to God. And he rolls straight into that beautiful thought. And yes, Ryan, he really did believe it. There is no condemnation. The Father, as I said this morning, will never be ashamed, has never been ashamed of you, and never will be ashamed of you. Has never been embarrassed by you, and never will be embarrassed of you, because he'll never be ashamed of his own son or embarrassed of his own son. And so it is, this countercultural thing that we have got to learn when we understand that we are the image and the glory of God. Broken as we are broken and we are being transformed. But know this, the Spirit of God is not trying to fix us. The Spirit of God is seeking to transform us. It's a very different thing, a very, very different thing. That as the Spirit of God seeks to transform and to change our lives, what he is seeking to do is keep taking us back to Jesus. Keep taking us back and realizing, like I look across the bed and see Sue and say, oh my goodness, he is still there. He has never pushed me away. He's still smiling at me. He's still delighting in me. And yet he knows the truth about me. He knows the truth and he is still singing over me and delighting over me, as Zechariah would say. I don't know about you, but I think that's from that place we can change. And the change is an adventure in grace, rather than a miserable experience of trying to improve ourselves. I'll finish there. Do you want to say something in response? Sorry, this has gone for quite a while. Got a bit worked up. You want to say something in response? So I realize I've said some things here, some of which might sort of grate and some of them might be very hard to sit with, and as well as maybe hopefully a few you might be rejoicing inside. You might have a million questions and think, yeah, hang on, but what about this passage and what about that passage? And I really get that. But maybe just for the moment, in terms of the larger picture, anyone love to, and of course not just ask questions, but love to hear you pick up from this and speak to us about what is moving in your own heart. Up the back there, thank you.
Do you think there's a difference between the soul and the spirit?
No, I don't. I think we are one whole being. I think that if we try to think of ourselves as having three parts, we have selected out three parts out of 8, 9, 10 different things that the Bible actually describes as who we are. You know, that things, sometimes it's said that we feel things with the heart, with the soul, with the spleen, with the kidneys, and we've just selectively gone to those three things, I think again because of the influence of Plato. I think fundamentally that we are a whole. And besides, when the scripture uses language of soul, it doesn't mean some part inside of me, it means my life. It means life. That's enough to cause mayhem, I suppose. And I'm conscious that a lot of other people would disagree with that, and that's fine. I don't want to say this like, well, you're all wrong and I'm right. I hope I'm not playing those games anymore. There was a hand, there was one here, and then I've just seen one over there. Yeah, yeah.
I was just going to say that it's funny because the greatest time of freedom in my life has been when I did exist, except, hey, the victory's already been won, all I have to do is walk in that. And then since falling off, I've always been like, well, how do I get that back? So, like, I don't have to do it.
Yeah. It's an insidious thing, isn't it? Like, I think of, me as a dad, let's say I get this crazy idea in my head, I want to be a really, really, really good dad. And so I go to all the seminars and I read all the books and I get the DVDs and I'm really into it. I want to be a good dad, a good dad. And I'm so busy preoccupied with how to be a good dad and making sure I get it right. I say, just leave me alone, kids, I'm reading the book about how to be a good father, you know? And I actually end up, in some respects, not actually engaging with my children. Sue and I will talk about this on Tuesday night in relation to parenting, of where somehow the parenting becomes the issue more than the children. Someone over here was saying something. Yeah, Andrew. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's something to try to recapture in my own mind.
Yeah. Including when they play mud pies on the lounge room floor on the carpet. And the problem for us is that we load it up as sin. Let me digress just for a moment. You know, the scriptures tell us that Jesus is without sin. I'm thinking about Hebrews here in particular, and I'm wholeheartedly sold up to that one. Yeah. They also say that he learned obedience and that he became, whether you translate the word as perfect or mature, he became that. Now, doesn't that strike you as odd? Doesn't that sort of grate? And you think, oh, hang on a minute, if I was writing it, I wouldn't have said that. I wouldn't have said he became obedient. I'd have said he always was obedient. And I wouldn't have said he became perfect or mature. I'd have said he always was because he's the Son of God and he's sinless. But Hebrews is quite happy to say, no, he learns obedience and he becomes mature or perfect. How could that be? Well, another little one of my imaginations. I want you to imagine Jesus is a 2-year-old and Jesus is outside playing and with the dirt and whatever and a bit of water, and it's just he is having such a good time, right? And making these exquisite sandcastles and things out there out in the front yard. And then he just gets this incredibly creative idea. Let's do this in the bedroom. Not that actually Galilean Homes quite had that arrangement, but it doesn't matter. Right? Just for the sake of the exercise, let's do this in the bedroom, you beauty, right? So he gets his bucket and his mud and all the rest of it and charges into the bedroom, throws a whole lot on the ground in the bedroom, and he is just having the best time in the world with all this dirt and mud and everything on the bedroom floor. And Mary comes along and around the corner, and being the godly, the woman that she is, she says, Jesus! You don't play with mud in the bedroom floor! And Jesus goes, oh, okay, you don't play with mud on the bedroom floor. Okay, Mum, I'll help you clean it up. I think I got that one. I know it's a little playful, but he learns obedience. See, the only reason you could ever have problem with an imaginary thing like that is if you have fundamentally got a problem with what it is to be human. If you don't have a problem with what it is to be human, if you realize that we are the image and glory of God, then you have no difficulty with the fact that Jesus would learn things like this, just like us, that he would go through all this. You'd have no problem, for example, with you list in your mind half a dozen bodily functions that we all share as men. You have to leave out the ones that ladies only have. But just stick with the ones that we all share as men and women, and then realizing that Jesus did all of those. See, if you struggle with that, it's because you've got a Jesus in your head who's about this high at least off the ground and has got an inverted dinner plate behind his head. Right? And he's not actually human. But if Jesus is actually human, then these things present no problem at all. And in fact, we find ourselves in the wonder of it. As Hebrews says, we find ourselves able to approach someone who can sympathize, able to come up to a big brother who can say, it's okay, I've done this on your behalf, it's all right. Anyone else? There was one somewhere. Jason. This is Jason's twin, or triplet, because there'll be three questions at least. I've learned this.
One of the things I struggle with is performance.
Yeah.
I think it's because I hear through all scriptures and being raised a certain way, saying, go and do, or whatever. And, you know, I hear other things with, you know, we were human beings, not human doings kind of thing, right? And so I don't know where the fine line is in that, because we always feel like we're supposed to be going, doing stuff, and I think that we take away from that.
So here's my shorthand for this, and I know it's going to leave you with other questions, but I've found it provocative for me that I'm not as let me go back one step. It can sound for many of us when we talk like this as if there's this horrible, horrible possibility we're on a precipice here and maybe someone's going to take my words now as justification for doing whatever they want to do in their lives and sinning in any way they want to sin, right? I'm very conscious of that when I talk this way, just as was the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 6 when he says, shall we then go on sinning that grace may abound? And you've got to think about it. He's saying that because he believes that if we do go on sinning, grace will abound. He has no exit clause here. He has no escape clause. He has no clause that says, oh, no, wait a second, you took me too far. If you sin too much, then grace won't abound. He's not buying into that. He's saying grace will abound. So how then would I ever say, well, why don't I just use this as a free card to do whatever I want to do? And Paul takes them back to their baptism. Not the act and the ritual as such, but the identity. You were baptized into Christ. In other words, it's like my friend coming alongside of me and saying, Mark, Sue, remember her. Remember your children now. Remember, there she is. This is who you are. Not this game you're playing of being a single man. This is who you are. There she is. And so it is that I wonder if one shorthand way of thinking about this, of what does it mean like for our lives to nonetheless be purposeful and full of doing and acting and adventuring and exploring and all this, all of which is meant to resound to the glory of God. I wonder if one way of thinking about it is that, in fact, as I think the scriptures are suggesting, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is gone, by the way. It never reappears in the Bible anywhere. But the tree of life does reappear. And it reappears in two ways. It reappears as at the very end of the story, as all the nations are feasting off its fruits, and it's just extravagant now. The Greek's a little confusing. It either means there's 12 different fruits growing on the one tree, or there's a crop every month. Either way, you've got some heck of a tree there, right? This is tree 2.0, okay? But either way, but the Proverbs talk about wisdom being a tree of life. That to live wisely is in some way to live in a way that is giving out life and breathing in life. And that I wonder if that's not a way to think about it. I think if we think of ourselves that the Spirit of God has come to us, to draw some stories together here, I like to think that what the Spirit of God is trying to teach us to do is to learn how to doodle in the sand, like Jesus did. To learn how to live without judgment. To live without condemning ourselves or others, And that does not lead to a life of I'll just do whatever I jolly well feel like doing. It leads to a life that is lived on the corollary of grace, and that's love. A life that is lived radically on behalf of. That the very notion of self-interest is cut out from underneath us. Not because it is in a list of sins as such, but because it eats away at our humanity, and it will eat away, therefore, at your humanity if I choose to live in this way. So it's not a life that has no responsibility. Not at all. It's a responsibility to breathe life, not to spot sins. Anyone else? Janet.
I want to share a story that...
Please. Life breeds life, and judgment breeds judgment. Absolutely. Look, folks, it's 8:30, and I don't want any. You shouldn't feel like, oh boy, when's this thing ever going to stop, and I'm stuck here now. I'm just really happy to sort of say, hey, thank you so much for letting me come here. Sue and I come here and be with you all. Tomorrow night, I'm going to try and draw some of these threads together and push it on a little bit further. Tuesday night, Sue and I are going to together share some thoughts around parenting. It's not going to be, you don't think, oh, now we'll get the list of do's and don'ts. No, it's not going to be, it's not going to be like that. We're going to start by telling the story, with his permission, of our journey with our son through very dark years, and what it is in particular that I had to learn in that journey. Draw out from that some of the things that we've learned in our reflection with each other and with our son and with our daughters, and just see if we can share a few things that people might find hopeful. So many parents feel an incredible burden on them about it, feel like they're doing this lousy job and how the heck am I ever going to do it better and all the rest, and the last thing we want to do is add to that. We would hope if you're a parent and you come, you might leave with your heart a little lighter, not a little more burdened. So it's been terrific to be here. Later in the week, I'm going to have the incredible privilege, Sue and I both, of being with Alan and the rest of the team here, which over on Vancouver Island, which I've never been to. I'm really looking forward to that. And I've got to say, can I say to you know, I'm singling out Alan and Ryan here, just sort of, you know, just because I've got to know them a little bit, and just say, I have loved being with you these last few days. I've loved watching your eyes and your heart. I'm really looking forward to tomorrow night. And I just want to say, you have some people here who have loved you well for a long time. Loved you well. And it's an incredible privilege to come in on the back of that. It really is. So let me pray, and we'll call it a night. Is that okay? All right. Lord Jesus, every time we speak about you, our words fail at some point. Yet by your Spirit, you're so good to us, and you do bring us inside, and you do bring us understanding, and we'd be just stuck forever if we didn't have that. We thank you for the scriptures you've given us. We thank you that they're provocative. We thank you that they are reassuring. We thank you that they bring us comfort, and they stir us up. And Lord, I just pray the things that I've shared that really have no basis whatsoever in your great heart and plans for us, would you just let it just fall to dust? And those things that have come that reflect your heart, would you, by your Spirit, help find a home in our hearts, in our minds, in our lives, in our relationships? Because, Lord, we long for life. We know only too well the stench of death, and we long for freedom. We long for life. We long for heart. We long for lightness. We long for the kind of grace where we give up performance and expectation, where we can sit with the brokenhearted and without all of the games that we play. And Lord, this is only you can do this for us, because I'll just go back to what I've always done in the past without you. So we covet your presence by the Spirit. Go with us tonight. Affirm in us that which is worth affirming, and let fall what isn't. And thank you so much, Lord, that you're never ashamed of us. You're never embarrassed. Thank you that you'll never condemn us. We love you, Lord Jesus.